Is blockchain the future of transparency in fashion? Is the future of fashion circular? And if so, what does it look like? Big questions that we're deep diving into with Stephanie Crespin, the founder and CEO of ReefLaunt and Style Troopy, using innovative technology to advance the luxury fashion industry to embrace the circular economy. In this episode, we talk about the scale and potential for a circular fashion industry, where 95% of inventory is locked up, where responsibility should lie, and why there is never any finish line. It's time to live wide awake. Hey, it's Steph Dixon, and welcome to the podcast. Here, we get into the minds of some of the most conscious humans around the world to understand how our actions affect our mental well-being, happiness, and the planet. Because self and planetary healing is really an inside-out job. So let's unpack this human experience together so that we can live wide awake. Born in Japan, Stephanie Crespin is a Belgium-French entrepreneur that has spent her life between Tokyo, Bangkok, Paris, Brussels, Singapore, and now Lisbon. With a double master's in business engineering and SME creation, Steph started her career at Procter & Gamble in fine fragrances. And in 2013, she embarked on her entrepreneurship journey when she launched her first company, Style Tribute, reselling secondhand luxury. This led her to launch ReefLaunt in 2017, which connects brands with technology to reclaim the secondary market while solving some of the industry's sustainability problems and supporting the shift towards circularity. You're going to hear a lot more about this in today's conversation. Steph's a dear friend, and I'm really excited to dive into this chat with her today. So, yeah. I think we'll just dive right in. But I wanted to ask, I read something about you today. It was actually really fun reading about you because obviously we're friends and I've known you for a long time, but then like stalking you on the internet was really fun because I like learned all this stuff about you that I didn't know. And I was like, wow, I'm a really terrible friend. Like I didn't know you were born in Japan.
You
like,
didn't?
No.
Well, I don't, that's not the first thing I tell my friends about, but yeah,
it's true.
Yeah, Tokyo. I was born in Tokyo, and my brother actually is Japanese, is adopted in Japan. We lived right there 6 years.
I mean, I knew that part, but I didn't know you were also born there. It's like,
yes.
Yeah, crazy. And you used to want to be an artist when you were younger?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, I draw pretty well.
Do you? I'm just learning all these things
painting,
about you.
Painting and creativity workshops with my kids, so I knew I wouldn't make a living out of it. I'm not that talented. So yeah, I went in business and engineering and math stuff, which is quite the opposite. My childhood kind of dream was becoming an artist.
That's, yeah, really fascinating. And then you went into engineering, which I think is also like, again, that was something I was like, wow, I didn't know she studied engineering. This is what I'm saying. I felt like a terrible friend. I knew so little about your history. So how did you then wind up in fashion? Like how did you go from studying engineering and then ending up in fashion?
So I studied, it was like commercial engineering. So it's not like pure mechanical engineering. There's some business in there. And then my first job was in P&G, so Procter & Gamble, where I was taking care of their fine fragrances. So trying to get closer to a creative industry, which was fine fragrances, but still in Procter, we can't really say it's that funky. And then basically after 5 years, I don't know, I really wanted to start my own thing, become an entrepreneur. And it felt like a bit superficial to go into fashion. And it felt that it was kind of the dream of two out of three girls that wanted to start something in fashion. So kind of kept that as a faraway dream. And then arriving in Singapore, I was talking to an entrepreneur who actually had some concept stores in Europe, and he wanted to launch that in Singapore. And so I suggested and proposed myself to kind of do the industry benchmark and the market study to see if there was an opportunity for him to launch his concept stores over there. And that's where I got even closer to kind of that industry that I wanted to work in. And after coming back to him saying that basically the possibility of launching a concept store very close to what Kids 21 or Club 21 is doing, that was kind of one foot in the door, and I never got out. So that was one of the elements that got me closer to fashion. The other element was that, well, you know me personally, I'm not usually wearing a hoodies, but yeah, fashion is clearly one of my key interests, but more particularly vintage and unique pieces. And I've been scouting a lot when I was younger for, you know, in flea markets and in thrift stores, and just felt that it combined so many different aspects of the fashion that I loved, which is uniqueness, the luxury piece, you know, and then quality and because it also combines a lot of artisanal stuff and items, but also, you know, it has a positive impact, or it has a better impact than buying anew. So all this combination, you know, makes me passionate about vintage. And that's what brought me one step closer to circularity as well. And in my studies, I had studied environmental economy. So studying basically the impact of different business models, and that got me really thinking about my next business and how I wanted to shape my first venture.
Great. So maybe you can unpack a little bit then on how you started your first venture and how it then evolved into Reflaunt.
Sure. So I started my first venture about 8 years ago. It's called Style Tribute. It's a secondhand luxury marketplace, very similar to Real, Vestiaire Collectif. Customers can basically put on sale their past purchases, and it enables other fashion lovers to purchase luxury items at a fraction of the price. So through this first experience, I was confronted to key challenges and pain points that then led me to incept Reflaunt. And those challenges can basically be summarized in three big pain points. The first one being that when you scale a marketplace, you're always after pieces, assortment, product, supply. That's kind of your main objective and what keeps you up at night. The issue with the luxury kind of category is that it's much harder to put your hands on that type of supply than having a marketplace like Carousel, where anyone can start selling any kind of crap they have around their houses. So that first kind of challenge was my main driver of thinking of how absurd it was to think that, you know, a same customer was buying and reselling a same product, yet through two disconnected experiences, right? First buying it with a luxury brand and then reselling it with me. And so it got me thinking that if I was able to integrate or to connect with the brands or with the retailers, I would then be able to piggyback on their own customer base and enable the acquisition of supply in a much more efficient manner. The second pain point was, okay, so as we scale this assortment and we acquire more products, and I scale Style Tribute with more and more pieces, how can I minimize the pain point of digitalization? Because in the secondhand world, each item is unique and each item needs to be listed from scratch, right? So you need, if you've ever resold stuff, you know it as well. You need to take pictures of the product, you need to add a description, the material, and it's a real pain in the ass, right? And if you're on the marketplace, well, you have to do that for your customers. So amazing service, but very expensive and not very scalable because each item is unique. So once you've sold that item, then that piece, you start from scratch. So I was trying to figure out these unit economics and trying to figure out this cost structure and trying to make this business model fly, given that I had so much cost around the operations. And then the third pain point was around authenticity. So this is really specific to high-end and to luxury, but the counterfeit problematic is a huge one, right? And when you think about it, again, due to the fact that we're disconnected and not working with brands and retailers, we're missing out on a big piece of the puzzle, which is the provenance of the products. So customers were coming to me wanting to sell their items, but I had no way of verifying where they had actually purchased those items. So yes, we built internal capabilities to check the items, but that's based on human expertise and capabilities. It's not based on data or, you know, traceability or transparency of where that product came from.
So these three pain points really got me thinking. And what I realized is all were intertwined with the same main problem, which was secondhand and firsthand are disconnected and they're working in silos, right? The fact that they're disconnected are driving those big inefficiencies for all stakeholders, for the customer, because basically it's making the whole hassle and it's bringing friction around the whole resale process, for marketplaces because they have lack of visibility on where the products are coming from. They need to spend huge amount of marketing to acquire the products. And then for the brands, of course, there's a huge and humongous lack of opportunity or missed opportunity around the fact that there's booming secondhand market that is out there, but they're missing out on the sales of their own products. And they're not tapping into that market and not benefiting one dime out of it. So this is what really led me to Reflaunt and to incepting and to imagining a technology that would bridge the firsthand, so the retailers and the brands, with the secondhand market, enabling those, resolving those three pain points and those three issues.
Yeah, it's so fascinating and so integrated what you've been able to achieve and really addressing such a variety of pain points from different stakeholders. I think it's always been very impressed with this concept and what you've been building. How has it been received since you've been over the last couple of years, and where are you sort of at right now in terms of the tech stack and the partners you're working with and how it's actually functioning in real life?
Yeah, I think what's super interesting is that despite the fact that the secondhand market is booming, it's in the media all the time. It has had great spotlight and focus this year and the past years, and people are extremely excited about it. And there is a huge shift in terms of behaviors and in consumer habits. However, what's really exciting is that when you read, for example, the Business of Fashion report that has been done with McKinsey, is that they state that only 5% of the resellable inventory has been unlocked and is actually selling today online, meaning that there's still 95% to be unlocked, right? And today we're already talking about a market that is $130 billion worth. And if you look at now the overall market opportunity, we're looking at $2.2 trillion worth of inventory locked in people's closets. So we're looking to unlock 95% of that. Now, what will happen is that, of course, over the years, the marketplaces have evolved, have improved in terms of customer experience, and there has been an improvement in terms of infrastructure. There has been new marketplaces emerging in different parts of the world, et cetera, et cetera. So that has unlocked this adoption among customers, and people have started to sell and buy more and more secondhand. But there's still the rest of the iceberg to uncover, right? We're only uncovering the tip of the iceberg. And to do that, where I'm really excited is seeing brands and retailers now entering that space and accelerating this adoption and this education among customers. Because what will happen is that once we integrate resale as part of the existing customer journey, we'll be able to make resale really part of any shopping experience, right? Today, it's, as said previously, it's siloed, meaning that you purchase your item with a brand, and then afterwards you 6 months later or 2 years later, you do the research online to choose where you will be able to resell it, at what price. You try to educate yourself on if the marketplace with which you're reselling it is credible, and you try to collect a lot of information. But all of that requires you to educate yourself and to spend time on the net, right? Whereas in the future, you'll actually have that all integrated within the brand. So the brand itself, within the customer journey, it won't end with the sale of the product. There will be an extension of that customer journey that will integrate the portion of resale, right? And so as of the moment you've purchased something with any brand, that brand will be held responsible in regards to what you're doing with that product, right? So if you're happy with it, of course, you won't be reselling it. But if you're not, the brand will have the responsibility to offer alternatives to your product. So whether it be through resale, through upcycling, through rental. And that's where I see like a step change in the dynamics of the secondhand is with this entrance of the brands in, and the retailers. And that's also where Reflaunt wants to play a major role, is in accelerating basically this integration of the brands and retailers and empowering them with a resale service, facilitating basically how they will build up that resale service for their own customer base. But Steph, I realize that I haven't explained exactly how the technology works.
Yeah.
So maybe I should start with that. Basically, very, very simply, let's imagine that you've bought, what's your favorite brand, Steph?
Well, I really like Prada at the moment.
Prada. Okay, let's go with Prada then. I'm hoping that Prada will sign off with us. So Prada, you've bought a beautiful Prada bag. You know, unfortunately, after 6 months, you realize that it's giving you back pain because despite it being very beautiful, it's a tote bag, it's heavy in leather and the hardware is quite significant. And you decide that, you know, it's just taking the dust in the closet and you're conscious of that. So you decide to sell it off and you log back onto your Prada account. And there you have all your historical purchases, including that beautiful Prada bag. And you have a resale button next to it. So you click that resale button and that triggers three pop-ups. One that will ask you to add the current condition of the item. The second asking you to add a few pictures of any signs of use of the item. And the third pop-up will give you directly the pricing range of the item at which you should be selling it, right? So first of all, that process is simplified. The whole resale process is simplified because your listing is already pre-created, right? It's pre-populated with the beautiful pictures that Prada took of your item, the description, you're tired. It's not filled with typos. It's the beautiful description that has been done by a merch from the Prada team. It has information and details on where the material comes from. In the future, it could even have information on the footprint, you know, on the environmental kind of impact that this item has. Everything is possible depending on what the brand will have invested in creating that digital passport of that item. And you just have to complement with information related to the condition. On top of that, since we know what you're selling, we know how to guide you, right? We know that the pricing should be ranged within 1,000 to 1,200 euros, for example. And beyond that price, you will not be reselling it, okay? Because we scrap data on 27 marketplaces in our network. So once that's done and we have that product listing, it's broadcasted on our 27 marketplaces. So to date, we have marketplaces across the globe, in the US, in Europe, in Asia. And once a shopper comes along and purchases from one of these marketplaces, it's delisted from the other marketplaces and you receive a DHL shipping label where you can schedule either your pickup or your drop-off at a DHL drop-off. And the item is sent either to the marketplace, either to the end buyer. And you finally end up being able to choose between a payment in cash or a payment in shopping credits. Now, the best thing about it is that Prada will top up that value with 20% additional. So rather than being paid 1,000 euros, you're paid 1,200 euros in shopping credits to buy again with Prada. So if you come back to the pain points I was talking earlier on, you know, one of the pain points was the traceability as well. Well, here, since we're integrated in the back end of brands and retailers, we're actually also able to trace back the provenance of these products. And we're able to guarantee that you, Steph, have actually purchased that bag, that specific model with Prada at, you know, in January 2018. And yet we even know that you bought it, you know, in France, for example. And when we can even recoup that information with the type of hardware that your bag has and where you purchased it. So all that information not only gives us a lot of credibility around the authenticity of the item, but it also gives a lot of information on the seller himself or the criteria around the product that an authenticator, if he wanted, could check on top of, you know, could enrich his opinion on whether or not it's authentic or not.
Wow, this is a crazy exciting and amazing how easy it sounds and so integrated as well. So at this stage, what kind of partners are you working with already? I know that you mentioned like Net-a-Porter, right?
So we're working with Net-a-Porter, which is a retailer we're very excited about, of course, and we've launched 3 months ago. It's going extremely well. We launched in the UK, we launched in US, and we're now rolling out to other parts of Europe, in Asia as well. So that will be a core focus for this year. We're also rolling out to other brands of the Richemont Group. So Mr. Porter, the Outnet, and then we have other great plans with other of their portfolio brands that we'll be announcing in the year. We're also working very tightly with the Kering Group. So Balenciaga being one of our pioneering brands, they were one of the first ones. So I have immense admiration and also very grateful to have taken on board this beautiful brand and super grateful that they trusted Reflant in the early days. And then the H&M group, so H&M, COS, and then other retailers like Harvey Nichols or other brands like Axel Arigato or Gani. And I'm sure we've missed a few, but yeah.
Yeah. And so I guess over the years, you know, you've worked a lot in the luxury sector. How has your view of sustainability and fashion evolved and changed in this time?
I think where it's evolved is clearly around the product life cycle. So, you know, if you look at the value chain, there is a tremendous amount of work to be done when it comes to the materials we use and the technologies that we use and how products are produced, right? And with what kind of materials and how we're dilapidating raw materials. But if you look at where there's the lowest hanging fruits and where we can, as consumers, have the biggest impact is really in terms of consumption and the wastage that we're driving. So that's really where I decided to focus my attention on by, you know, starting off First Style Tribute, which was giving secondhand or second life to products, and then Reflant. But all in all, what's interesting is how we can extend further on that product life cycle to not a second life, but a third life, and all the services around a single item that are starting to appear, like, as you know, repair, for instance, that seemed to be completely outdated and a bit like a traditional non-scalable kind of service, now is reappearing in force. Everything that is around upcycling and repurposing as well, everything around personalization, so around an item that you could give a second life but repurpose for someone else and personalize to make it more adapted to his or her use. So it's interesting to see all these new technologies and services around more of giving and perpetuating the life cycle of items versus, you know, being in the creation and always having new products that you put on in this world. I mean, I know that for at least for myself, I'm trying to shop as much as I can in different, I would say, mediums or channels where I know that either the fabrics have been reused, either that it's secondhand, either that it has been upcycled in some manner, and it's not a new creation and a new product that we've put on the world, driving more waste and new consumption of raw materials. I think that is where it's the most important for me. How can we make the best of what we have already, basically?
Yeah, I completely agree. And I'm exactly the same. Do you feel like we are still the minority, though? You're obviously in the fashion industry all day, every day. Are you seeing that a lot of people are starting to make this shift, or are we still really behind than where we need to be?
I would say it's not equal depending on the markets, for sure. You know, markets like the Nordics, Europe and the US, well, certain parts of the US are much more mature when it comes to secondhand and rental and all those new new kinds of ways of consuming. But all in all, I would say, yes, we're still, as I was saying in the introduction, only uncovering the tip of the iceberg, right? It's very positive because there's an adoption rate that is very fast, and we're seeing this market grow exponentially and at a pace that is incredible. But still, we still have, you know, 95% of it to be unlocked when it comes to items sitting in people's wardrobes. So that's an indicator of the work that we still need to do. And then afterwards, I mean, the great indicator and the green flag is that brands and retailers today are putting that very high up in the priority setting and in their agendas. So I believe in a year or from now, or maybe 2 years from now, clearly all brands and retailers will have some kind of upcycling, recycling, secondhand rental kind of solution that they will be providing to their customers. I'm 100% sure of that, because they have that obligation and that responsibility in regards to their customers. So that, I think, is super positive. Where I see where we need to improve is going a bit more drastic and rethinking the whole entire customer journey. Again, not replicating the issue that we see today where we have firsthand and secondhand, meaning that it's great to have a secondhand or repair service that's there for customers. But then if you really want to do it seriously, the brand needs to integrate it completely in its customer journey and multiply the touch points of education, multiply the touch points of communication, simplify the customer journey to make it super accessible for all their customers. And I think that will come in a second stage, but we're not there yet. So the adoption will, you know, within each customer database will take the time, depending how much the brand invests in. From more, a state and you know, institution level, I think where we will also see a drastic shift is once we start putting in place policies that reflect, you know, the cost that companies, the corporate sector, but also consumers are generating. And you know, by penalizing, for example, brands or retailers that don't demonstrate sufficient effort and investment to put in place initiatives for upcycling, recycling. And actually, that's what they're starting to do, for example, in France, right? So it started with the end of stock, but I think more and more brands will be kept liable for all the products that they put in this world. And, you know, we're going to be shifting from a world where brands, their first objective was to sell products. And as the moment they sold the item, it wasn't their problem anymore. It wasn't their ownership anymore. Today, even though it's sold, it will still be their responsibility on what options they give their consumers, their customers, to what, how do you say, afterlife they're giving to those products and how they're facilitating that for their own customers.
Yeah, I think the policy part will become very interesting. And I think then we'll start to truly see brands having to finally make more sustainable commitments and take the responsibility that they should be taking for what they're doing and what they're bringing into the world. So I think that's a very, very important point that you've raised there. And I guess I'm curious as well about the applications of blockchain in the fashion industry and how you're sort of integrating that as well. Is that how the products are also verified, like through the system? And are there other applications that you're seeing that are using blockchain that are exciting in this space?
So blockchain is interesting, and we've integrated that as part of our tech stack. The reason that now is not a key focus or priority for the coming years is that we feel that brands and retailers are not yet there in regards to the maturity of their reflection around blockchain, right? It's a huge commitment, and they're still trying to understand what implications it has with their business and with which providers and how they want to
set up, you know, those types of services, which usually blockchain for the luxury category is for reasons of traceability and battling against counterfeit. So we felt that, you know, we shouldn't integrate a blockchain solution for the time being because it felt like it was just extending the sales cycles that we were experiencing with each brand because it was involving too many questions, too many doubts, and too much internal alignment and approval process. So we parked that. However, we're working and discussing with different blockchain solutions and technologies, and we're agnostic, meaning that in the midterm, if a brand comes to us and says, we are working with this blockchain and we have these types of smart contracts that we would like to emit with the sale of each product, we would be able to integrate and base our technology on different types of blockchains, blockchain solutions. So we've taken a path where basically we would integrate that part of the stack within our service, but we're not focalizing our resources and our investments in deploying our own. I still think there's a long way to go till there's really a market adoption. So we're kind of parking that and observing how brands and retailers are behaving themselves in regards to it.
Yeah, it sounds like the industry is maybe just a little slow on the uptake because I'm sure that's going to be where the future goes, especially with all the issues that you pointed out in the beginning and all the things that you guys are solving for.
Yeah, exactly. And on top for us, it's not a prerequisite because a blockchain really truly makes sense once the authority so is not credible. In our case, the authority is the brand or the retailer. So if he says that he sold this product to that or that person and that he sold this SKU with that unique identificators, there's no reason why we shouldn't trust that brand and doubt in that registry and that kind of database, right? So it doesn't really make sense for the first sale. This being said, you know, with our smart button and with the ability to integrate in the backend with brands and with new technologies, with chips that are being, you know, physical chips that are being put on the items, we will be able to link the product ID, so the product, the digital passport of the item once it's sold with the physical chip. So that once you, let's go back to the example of the Prada bag, you sold your item to, you know, a secondhand buyer, she will be able to scan the physical chip on the product and check that the purchase that she has made online with the digital passport of the product is actually matching the physical chip of the item. So she knows that that item that she has purchased from you, that is authentic or that is, you know, the real customer of Prada, you actually shipped the authentic or the real item that was stated on the digital listing. So linking both the physical asset and the digital asset.
Yeah, very interesting. I guess, you know, I'm also curious if there's almost a missed opportunity for these brands to sort of integrate in some way NFTs or other digital assets that they can share with the community of like the first buyer to sort of give them exclusivity to something else. I guess probably seeing more of that in the coming years, but something very interesting and exciting to watch the space. And I guess with that in mind, you know, what do you think we're going to be seeing that is exciting in the next couple of years? And do you think that we'll ever see a truly sustainable fashion industry within our lifetime?
I think truly sustainable fashion doesn't exist as an absolute, or it's going to be difficult to get to an absolute, you know, we would have to be naked and wear leaves and flowers, you know, but even there we could argue that, you know, the way that we pick the flowers and the leaves to cover our bums would need to be done in a certain process. So a purely sustainable fashion, I don't know if it's attainable, but improving it radically, yes, I do believe that we'll get there in our lifetime. I hope so. I think we're going to shift from a mindset where, you know, we were, the more we produce, the more we grow from a corporate standpoint of view, whereas now we've reframed kind of value around each product. And I think with one single product, we can actually drive many, many different sales and transactions. So this is the simple concept of second hand and third hand and fourth hand. But I also think that it will, if you push kind of the reflection further on, the monetary source or you know, the business model will not be around the sale of the product itself, but more around the services around it. So the repair, the rental, the personalization. And so it could be that we get to a point a bit like you see other businesses doing that, right? You have, like, for example, a business of tires or the business of light bulbs, where you have services that provide you with the product, right? But they don't charge you on the tires. They charge you on the fact of changing these repairs and changing these tires.
Yeah. So it's like lighting as a service.
Yes, exactly. So it forces the company to align their interest with the product, with the extension of the life cycle of the product, right? Because the longer these light bulbs can perform, the better and the most economical as well their service is. And I think for the rest of the economy, it may move into that, meaning that, and that's what we'll be seeing as well with secondhand, right? It's the starting point of that, because suddenly brands and retailers will come to a point where they'll realize that if they want to survive in this new dynamic, they will need to put in the world products that are coveted on the secondhand market. Because as people will be buying and selling, they'll be starting to integrate in their consideration of purchase the value that they could capture in the resale, right? So if you buy an item and you know there's no secondhand resale market, you're better off buying something else, another type of product that does have a value on the secondhand market. So brands and retailers will be forced to reflect on the product lifecycle and on the quality of the products that they're putting out there, right? And this can be pushed further along, right? It's how easy the products will be repairable, right? Because we know that the secondhand market is so important. How can we integrate a repair service so that people can capture a higher value once they decide to resell it, right? Or then rental and so on. You could even look into leasing. But all of that forces brands and retailers to rethink the way that they produce and the way that they're actually, you know, growing their business.
There's a lot to be excited about and a lot to look forward to in the fashion industry. And I hope we start seeing exponential growth towards these more sustainable yes. practices and not having things going quite as slowly as I believe they have been in the last couple of years. But yes. I'd like to switch gears a little bit and talk a little bit about the other aspects of your life outside of sustainable fashion. Because, Steph, I mean, I've been friends with you for a while now, and you really are quite the superwoman. I've always admired how you've not only run one, but two companies that are literally innovating and pushing boundaries, but you also have three gorgeous boys, and you still make time for me as a friend. So I'm just curious, you know, what keeps you sane through all of that? Like, what do you do to keep you like grounded, and where do you get your energy and motivation for to keep going?
Yeah, well, I love what I'm doing. I think it's a question of loving what you do, feeling empowered, feeling that you know, you can make a difference. I mean, it sounds obvious, and it's probably not the most, you know, original answer, but I can't really think of much more. It's, I wake up in the morning and I feel energized and I'm happy to go to work. And in the evening, you know, when it's required to work long hours, it's not a pain. It's a pleasure. So I really do believe that as soon as you found something that you feel passionate about and you feel that, you know, you have purpose around, and you also align kind of your capabilities with the mission or
the product or the service that you're building, then everything seems much easier, right? The struggle one comes in when you're not in that sweet spot and you're not aligning basically your purpose, what you love, and your key capabilities with what you're trying to build. So I think that's really that.
Yeah, I love that. And finding that sweet spot. And I think that's, yeah, really beautifully put. Thank you. And I know you recently read a book that really spoke to you. So I want to talk a little bit about that book and the sphere of influence that you want to have around that dialogue.
Yes. Oh my God. So that book pushed me in a mini depression, but but at the same time...
What's the book called first?
So it's called Le Bug Humain, so the human bug. It's Sébastien Boller. It's a French neuroscientist that wrote the book. And basically, he came from a very different approach to the environmental crisis, right? And the angle that he took was to study basically the human brain, understanding why basically... Well, you've seen Don't Look Up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So in the movie Don't Look Up, basically the key question is, why do we as humans know that we're killing ourselves, killing the planet, but also driving the extinction of the human race? And while knowing that, we're continuing to do business as we always did, to consume as we always did, and we're not making any drastic changes and moves. And basically, he tries to explain it by studying how our human brain works, right? And what he explained in a nutshell is that you have the heart of your brain, which is the striatum, which drives all your needs, all your instincts. So it's sex, it's your appetite, so it's hunger, it's your need for social positioning, it's your laziness, so the ratio of effort versus the output you deliver. And all of those kind of instincts drive your desire, right? Drives you as a human being. And then you have the cortex, which differentiates us from animals, right? And allows us to plan ahead, to see, to have vision, to do compromises and sacrifices for the future, right? And what he says is that over the years of humanity, we have been working as slaves for the stratum to facilitate the way we get food, to facilitate the way that we get sex, you know, now with pornography being all over the internet, with food being at the tip of our fingers, with Uber, with our laziness, you know, having Ubers driving us all around. So all of that has been great because it has enabled us to unlock huge innovation and progress, and we've done beautiful things, right? But at the same time, we've now come to a point where that cortex, which was there basically to plan, for example, for the next season of wheat that we needed to exploit, and all those compromises that we needed to make because we didn't have that innovation and that comfort at the tip of a finger, is not needed anymore. So we don't exercise so much the need of having to wait around, to be patient, and to plan ahead. And so he basically comes down, and it's a very simplified, you need to read the whole book because I'm taking many shortcuts, saying that humanity today is less and less capable of really doing the sacrifices and having that vision and planning ahead due to the facility and the consumerism in which we have built our whole society on. So yeah, it was enlightening, I think, because to me as a mother, it gave me a lot of solutions or insights on how I wanted to educate my kids, and that will be part of the next generation, and how to help them actually battle this this stratum who is pushing us to consume more and more and demand this and that immediately, really.
Yeah, it sounds fascinating. And you mentioned that you had a little bit of eco-anxiety after reading it, which it sounds like it's very normal. So what did you do to sort of pull yourself out of the eco-anxiety? Or are you still there?
I'm still there.
No. I mean, it's not a laughing matter, but
no, it's not a laughing matter. Look, yes, definitely I'm still in it and I'm still trying to grasp what that means, you know, in terms of what's actionable, because it did leave me hanging a bit on, okay, I'm a drop in the ocean. How can I actually make an impact? And I think actually I found a lot of reassurance or comfort in having discussions with my friends, with my peers, even with my kids as well, to see that it resonated and to see that there is this strong desire of making a change, that it's also a matter of education, because maybe, you know, it was a big change in the way I thought about the environmental crisis and it made it really real for me. I'm sure there's other ways of looking at it and that may not be this book. So I think over time, and I know that we're out of time and that's the whole point, but education and communication around this is increasing and accelerating. And I do think that, you know, with also the younger generation, the reflection around which we're at is going to sound absurd. And I'm hoping that it won't take too much time for us to realize that. And, you know, yeah, I can just hope for that, I think, at this stage.
Yeah. And I think that's a good hope and a good channel. And I think it's these books and these types of interaction with different types of media that allow you to then be able to foster new conversations and bring the people in your sphere of influence in and further dialogue and discord and conversation. I think that's so important. And I think we also underestimate the impact and the ripple effects that those types of conversations can have on the people in our lives. So I think it's great that this kind of reignited that passion in you almost to then go out and have more deeper conversations again and in it with a new mindset. So I think that's, it's really good that we continue to invest in our knowledge and also push our boundaries and read stuff that is a little bit painful, but also reminds us exactly of the reality that we're facing. So I'm going to look it up. Exactly. Hopefully they have an English translation. What advice would you give your younger self if you were to go back in time?
To enjoy the road and not to see it as an end goal, because it actually never stops. So I think I lost a few years of health and well-being, mental well-being, having the impression that it was a race and that I was close to the finish line. There is no finish line. I mean, the journey itself is the whole point. So that would be one of the main things that I still need to remind me of and I still need to work on. But I wish I had learned that earlier on. And I wish I was living up to that message as much, a bit better even now. But I think that's the main point.
Yeah, no, it's one I continually have to remind myself of as well. So I'm glad you brought it up again, because, yeah, it's good to be reminded of these simple yet very powerful truths in our lives. How do you think that we can live wide awake?
Live wide awake. I mean, when I see my children, so I gave birth this year, and I think live wide awake, you know, you kind of re-experience the basics of what is living wide awake when you see a newborn and seeing your children. What is it? It's that curiosity, that fascination. He smiles all the time, being happy for just very simple things. I think COVID was dramatic on certain regards, but also extremely positive at others, because it also pushed us to rethink and not reborn, but kind of pause and take the time to to reappreciate the little things that we have lost appreciation for. So I think it's really about that foremost, is taking the time to look around us and be curious and feeling connected with one another. I think empathy goes a long way. That's one of the key, I would say, skill sets that I try to exercise every day,
And I feel that is keeping me young is empathy. What about you, Steph? I'm very interested to hear your answer on this one.
How do I live wide awake? I think it's just, for me, it's all about remembering and finding the awe and joy in life. Because when I have those moments of just absolute awe of the incredibleness of nature and us as part of that nature, then it really reminds me that I'm alive. And that feeling of aliveness makes me feel like I'm super awake. So I'm always reminding myself and trying to expose myself to those moments of awe and just joy. Because I think joy is the most magical emotion for me on earth. And so the more that I can tap into that pure joy and awe, the more that I feel alive.
Yeah, that's what
that's me.
Beautiful. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Steph, so much for this wonderful conversation and for sharing your time and knowledge and just like excitement for what's to come in the fashion industry.
Well, thanks, Steph, for inviting me. I enjoyed our talk so much and looking forward to seeing you in person.
Yes, hopefully it's not too far away. Three things I'm taking away from this conversation with Steph. Firstly, 95% of inventory is locked in people's closets. That's a huge opportunity to circulate what already exists. Secondly, brands should be held responsible for what they bring into the world. We can help to advance this by asking for it with our local government and putting pressure on brands. And thirdly, it actually never stops. There is no finish line, and the journey itself is the destination. So enjoy the ride. I'm curious, what did you think about the episode and what were your main takeaways? Is there a topic you want me to dive deeper into? I'd love to hear from you. You can find me at Steph L. Dixon or at Live Wide Awake. If you got something out of the podcast and you want to continue this journey with us, consider subscribing and supporting. I hope that today's conversation stirred something deep within you, ready to awaken. And until next time, live wide awake.